Both of them came to me for the same reason. They had had problems in their marriage. They both had gone to another Christian counselor. He had told both of them the same thing. He had told them that what they needed to do was have a couple of affairs so they could get loosened up and then they could have better sex with their husbands. And both of them realized, this isn't right. And so they quit going. Now, I don't remember how they got to me. This is 15 years ago. I don't know how they got to me. But I ended up seeing both of them at the same time. I mean, during the same block of time. Totally independent from each other. Got the story from both of them. So I tend to think it was probably accurate. That man's conscience was not a God-derived conscience. It was a culturally derived conscience because his conscience said to him, what I need, I'll feel good about this if I can get these two women able to function better in their marriage. That was where he was deriving his conscience from. But God's dictation of his conscience would be, they need to learn how to function in this relationship within the parameters that God says sexuality is to be practiced, and to find out what was going on that was making them so rigid. By the way, just an aside here, one of the most enjoyable kinds of counseling is sexual counseling, because it's one of the easiest places to help people, because very seldom is a sexual problem a physical problem. Once in a while, but very seldom. Very seldom is a sexual problem actually a relational problem. Most of the time, a sexual problem is an inward attitudinal problem, most of the time. You help the person deal with the attitude, and the behavioral side of the sexuality begins to take care of itself. Now, I was taught that by my mentor, and I saw it actually happen in the second case I had when I was doing my internship. This couple came in, I went through their PDI forms, which we're going to talk about later, and their marriage was a mess. And they came in, we began to gather data, and one of them, that both of them had checked real big on the data form was sex problem. They had that check real big. You could tell both of them really felt it, you know. And the first thing I did, look at it and say, I don't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. And so I didn't. I dealt with the relational problems. Dealt with the other things that were going on. And about 6 weeks into the counseling, I finally said, I got to deal with this. If I don't deal with it, they're not going to be helped. And if I don't deal with it, my mentor is going to jump on my back. So I got to deal with it. So I turned to the PDI form and I said, I noticed when I was going through your PDI forms here and I looked at your problem list that you both had sex checked with a big, heavy check mark. I said, how's that area of your life now? And the guy leans back in his chair and he hooked his thumbs on his belt like this. He said, it's sweet. But I hadn't done anything to deal with the sexual side of his life. What we'd done is we'd worked out the internal attitudinal problems that in turn was putting a wall between them in terms of their physical relation. And that's what you frequently find. So I have found it to be one of the more enjoyable parts of counseling. Qualifying your professionalism. A under that is a relationship to a professional code. Relationship to a professional code. And I have beside it there NANC. That's just happens to be my professional code because it's the organization that I work with. There are other organizations. We'll refer in group class to the code for social workers. There's another code for psychologists. There's another code for other kinds of counselors. There's a variety of ethical codes. NANC is an organization that certifies biblical counselors, has no relationship to any state organization, and it is not certified by any state organization. It is strictly an organization that certifies people who counsel biblically and who meet their qualifications. And there is a code of conduct, code of ethics that goes with that. What you are required by law to do, licensed or not, what you're required by law to do is function within the code of ethics of the organization by which you're certified to counsel, whatever that organization happens to be and whatever that code of ethics happens to be. If I had to go to court, and I pray to God I never have to, but if I had to go to court and I had to give a rationale for why I work with somebody in a particular vein, I would say, well, because my code of conduct and my code of ethics says this is the way I'm responsible to deal with that particular kind of issue. And that code of conduct and that code of ethics is derived from our Christian stance in the world. And this is our religious perspective. This is where we believe we ought to be. This is the way we believe human beings ought to function. And this is what we're responsible to function within. You have a reasonable defense of your behavior under that set of circumstances. So even as Christians, even as lay counselors, even here at Briarwood, I'm sure that in the lay counseling department, they have some kind of ethical code of conduct that you function by. And so you're responsible professionally, even if you're a para-counselor, a para-professional, you still function within the code of conduct of the organization, of the structure in which you work. Just like ordination. I'm ordained in the PCA. It would not be looked upon very favorably if I were to stand up and preach speaking in tongues. Now, that's no slap at anybody in here who happens to preach speaking in tongues. But in our ordination standards, we take a vow not to do that, not to preach that particular doctrine. So to preach that is a violation of that. Now, that's just for illustrative purposes, but that's kind of the idea. You have a code of conduct that you work within. And then you have a relationship to legal authority and church authority. And I've been already expounding on the legal authority in terms of responsibility to your code of conduct, but you also have a responsibility to the legal code. And the legal code, perhaps for you and me, mostly revolves around confidentiality. When do we break confidentiality and when do we keep confidentiality? And generally speaking, I've listed here the times when you break confidentiality. One is when a person is at risk, that is, they're suicidal. Now, we're not going to get into evaluating how a person is suicidal here. That's not our purpose at this point in time. We'll take it up at another point in time in the curriculum. But once I have discerned that this person is really potentially suicidal, I need to not allow them to leave my office without having some kind of behavioral contract in place with them where they have made a covenant with me that they will call me or they will call somebody else, or like in the case of this other fellow, when the potential homicide was involved, I made him go home and get that gun and make a covenant to get that gun and take it to his pastor. That was a good illustration. And I told him if I didn't hear from him, I was going to call the pastor. That was breaking confidentiality. But it was because his wife was at risk. I might have been at risk. His kids may have been at risk. Same with suicide. If that person is at risk, that's a judgment call. But it's a judgment call you have to live with if you're going to be in a counseling environment. And then there's the abuse or threatened abuse. You know, sometimes we make a threat of abuse just because we're a flash in the pan angry. And if somebody does that in a counseling session, I usually stop right there. Whoa, let's stop right here, right now. I need for you to stop and evaluate what you just said. Was that a flash in the pan? Did that just pop off of your tongue? Is that a way of expressing your anger? Or are you seriously considering that that's the way you would deal with this teenage son, or that's the way you would deal with this wife, or that's the way you deal with this husband? By the way, don't let all the articles on wife abuse make you think that wives are the only ones that get abused. There are lots of husbands that get abused by wives. I had a guy 10, 12 years ago, his wife literally destroyed a chair over his head, picked it up and whopped him. So remember that when you think of spouse. I always like to talk about spouse abuse or mate abuse rather than wife or husband, because it goes both ways. Granted, there are more women that are abused than men, but our tendency is to think not in terms of men at all. I guess Bobbitt is the absolute example of that these days, that men can be abused too. And then criminal intent or criminal action. You could conceivably be charged with accessory if you had prior knowledge of criminal intent and did not break confidentiality and do something to stop it. That goes for any of us, not just as a counselor. And then church responsibility. Now, you've thought about legal responsibility. What about church responsibility? We don't think of that one too much because we don't think of the church having much authority these days, any way you cut it. But church responsibility. Keep the lines of authority and responsibility clear. I was on staff of several churches along the way as the counseling pastor. And not infrequently at a staff meeting, somebody would say, well, Howard, what about so-and-so? And I had a standard response. I just say, what about so-and-so? And I say, oh, yeah, that's right. You can't talk about that, can you? And that was just my standard response. Now, there were situations I could talk about. And we'll talk a little bit later about how to handle some of those. But there's a procedure for that. And I think we need to learn to respect that procedure in the church setting. It just works better for everybody. It's a little awkward. You have to go through a process, but it works better for everybody. We had a form in our office in St. Louis, was a release of information. And when people would come to see me, where the church was involved, they signed a release of information so that I could have exchange of information with their pastor. And I would encourage him on his end to get that same release of information on his end, just to keep everything above board and have a structure to work in. I'll tell you, these days, people are litigious crazy. And you may think you know somebody very well until they get stung by a hornet, and then you never know what they're going to do. So it's best to try to keep a structure and work by a structure. It just kind of tends to keep everybody out of trouble. Do not discuss cases with other pastors and other counselors without permission. The exception to that, if you're on a staff of peers, working with another staff of peers, and you're working with a case and you're discussing a case, or if you have an intern working with you, or you're an intern working with a supervisor, then it's understood that that's appropriate. And then respect for church orientation. I don't know how many we ended up with by the time we moved away from St. Louis, but I was involved in counseling up there for 8 years. And at one point, we had counted 147 different churches from which we had counselees. And they went the gamut from Greek Orthodox on this side to super right-wing fundamentalist on this side, and dispensationalist and reform, and Arminians and Calvinists, and Pentecostals and formalists, Episcopals to the independent Bible church down the street. I mean, you name it, and we saw people from those churches. Probably in 8 years, I can think of maybe two or three times where I talked to somebody about not going to a certain church anymore because something in that church structure was actually aggravating their situation. And when I would do that, I would first of all help them sort out on paper what we had come to was a point of real irritation in that relationship. And then I'd get them to go back to their pastor and discuss that with their pastor and try to resolve that situation. You know, even in a situation where somebody's doctrinal statement is way off to left field as far as you're concerned, and it seems like that may be the issue that's involved in the counseling process, I've found that most of the time, if you can get them to go back and discuss that with their pastor and how it's affecting them in their lives, that most of the time, it's their perception of what they're being taught that's the irritant and not what they're being taught. And so by respecting that church orientation and working with that pastor involved, one of those fellows called me one time. He said, I don't know you. And he said, I can't imagine that a Presbyterian would be nice to me. But he said, I want to tell you how much I appreciate you sent so-and-so back to discuss this issue. I said, well, brother, that's what Christianity's all about, isn't it? But he was amazed. He was of an ilk that wasn't thought very highly of by most other people. You know, they had some of their own peculiar quirks. I sure wouldn't be happy in that situation, but I'm not in it. And they worked that thing out in that relationship, and that particular issue was no longer an issue in that counselee's life. And she learned a very important lesson in the process. Responsibility for referral and collaborative counseling. Every once in a while, I shorthand counseling. Okay. Usually, I don't do that in notes I hand out. I didn't notice that was in there until just now, but I do that. There are situations you see, or you may see, that need to have collaboration. I've had many folks over the years that I've worked with a psychiatrist with that particular individual. I have had one recently where an older lady, where I've worked with her psychiatrist and I've worked with her medical doctor, because in her case, I was convinced that most of her problem had to do with the drug she was taking. And it's finally been worked down to the place where she's taken about 25% of what she was taking previously. And now she seems to be pretty stable. So there are lots of times when that's important. Now you're sitting there saying, this is really getting complicated. How do I keep all this stuff straight? Well, you hear it in this class, and you hear it in another class, and you hear it in another class. And that's what an internship is all about. When you get down to a place where you start doing an internship, it kind of pulls a lot of these things together. You see it happening, and you're part of it happening. So don't get scared and think, how will I ever get there? You get there the same way you get it there in every other profession, one step at a time. Qualifying your teaching. Qualifying your teaching. Let's stop the camera for a moment and take a break. And qualifying your teaching. First of all, qualifying the content of your teaching or your counseling, if you please, either way. And under that, I have the option. And the first one we have there is the integrationist view. The integrationist view. Now, none of these that I'm going to talk about are nice, neat, absolute categories. Wish they were, but they're not. There are some common concepts that show up in the integrationist viewpoint. One of those common concepts is what I call a this-is-that approach. Now, I'll give you an example of that. Freud's view of man is parallel to the Bible's view of man. Freud saw man as basically evil when you get right down to it. The Bible sees man as basically evil. So over here in psychology, you have this, and over here in Scripture, you have that. So this is that. But I want to tell you what. The difference between Freud's view of man and the Scripture view of man is as far apart as the East is from the West. But you have a lot of things that show up like that in psychology and the Scriptures. And when you try to bring them together by saying this is that and find a commonality between them, then you generate problems for yourself. Another common element you find that folks who want to take an integrationist perspective talk about is that all truth is God's truth. I mean, that's innocuous enough. How can you argue with that? All truth is God's truth. That's a truism. But what is meant by that is, if psychology, by natural revelation, discovered this over here and it's truth, we can accept it because all truth is God's truth. The problem is how do you know that this is truth? Yeah, all truth is God's truth, but how do you know this is truth? It may appear to be truth today. I mean, there was a point in our American history when, as far as our society was concerned, what Freud taught was basically truth. But that's not true anymore. But it was at one point. And then there's another common element in the integrationist view is what I call complementary. That is, the truth of psychology fleshes out the truth of Scripture. Maybe a good example of that would be Piaget's stages of development of the mind. But then that's not truth. Piaget, I think, did some very good work, at least when he came to his observations of lots of children and being able to categorize, generally speaking, how a child operated this age and how a child was able to operate at this age and how a child was able to operate at this age. And there is some usableness, if I can phrase it that way, to that conception of the way a child learns. But it's not necessarily truth. He made some observations, and he said this is the way it is. But that's not necessarily truth, because in reality, it may not be as it appears to be. It may only appear that it is that way. See, we don't know for sure, so we can't call it truth. So we can't therefore say it complements the truth given over here in the Scriptures. What you have in an integrationist view of psychology and theology, and there is a whole group of Christians out there in the world whose major position is we want to integrate psychology and theology, okay? But the problem is that's like putting apples and oranges in the same basket and calling them all oranges. They're two very different things. You can't integrate them that way. What you know by special revelation, that is, what God in His Word has declared is truth, no question about it. What we learn through natural revelation, by observation, and statistically taking those observations and working them out with ANOVAs and all those sophisticated research models that we use, is not absolute truth. It seems to be true that. When I went to the University of Georgia, Tom, you left that pedigree off tonight. When I went to the University of Georgia on my sabbatical and did a year's work of worth in gerontology, I had a seminar with one of the top five researchers in the country on gerontology, Dr. Leonard Poon. And we met in a room with a round table, and there were 17 or 18 of us in that room, and we each had to go out and do some research and come back and present something on aging and draw some implications from it. Well, I happened to get a subject that I was able to dovetail nicely with the Scriptures. And so I came into class and I thought, man, I had them. And so I made my presentation with gusto and enthusiasm, and I got down to the end and I said, therefore we may conclude. And Leonard Poon is sitting at the other end of the table and he said, Howard, in theology you may say, therefore we conclude. But in the social science class, you may only say, therefore it seems to be true that. And I looked up the table and I laughed at him. I said, thank you, Dr. Poon. I couldn't have said it better myself. I needed that reminder. Because he was 100% right. It seems to be true that. We may say that over here, but we may not say it is true that. Over here in theology, revelation, I should say in revelation more than theology, because you can't always say it in theology the way people do with theology, but biblically, what God says is true. Or as Dr. Van Til used to say, it's true truth. And if you will learn to keep those two spheres separated rather than trying to integrate them, it'll save you a great deal of confusion, and it will allow you to use a lot of the things we learn in psychology properly. But if you don't keep them separated, you'll end up with a great deal of confusion, and you will not utilize the tools that are available in psychology properly. As Francis Schaeffer taught us years ago, and very rightly so, when you put grace and nature on the same level, nature will always eat up grace. Now that sounds, huh? What do you say? When you put grace, that is, the knowledge of God, the truth of God, on the same level with nature, that is what you learn from natural revelation, nature will always end up eating up grace, because nature eventually cannot make place for grace. It will squeeze grace out. You think about that. Next is the eclectic view. The eclectic view. If you'll permit me, I'm going to read you a paragraph in my notes on eclecticism. The rise of eclecticism. Maybe I should say a word about what eclecticism is as a point, first of all. Eclecticism is taking some of this viewpoint, and some of this viewpoint, and some of this viewpoint, and some of this viewpoint, piece by piece, and kind of putting it together and trying to use it as a system. That's eclecticism. Each new system of therapy has faulted its predecessors on the ground, on one ground or another, and has claimed superiority to the predecessor. These schools, often lacking a base of research evidence, have presented an array of oppositional definitions, objectives, and therapeutic methods. Furthermore, advocates of the school approach, that means the Freudian school, the Adlerian school, so forth, the advocates of the school approach have adhered to a great leader methodology to promote the uniqueness of their single theory orientation. These tendencies prompted Carl Rogers to conclude nearly two decades ago, let me stop here and say, how many of you know who Carl Rogers is? Carl Rogers is one of the gurus in counseling. Had a tremendous influence on schools. Tremendous influence on education. Tremendous negative influence on education. But he also had a tremendous influence on counseling. Even in seminaries. In fact, for a long time, Carl Rogers' approach to counseling was the only kind of a counseling taught in seminaries for years. These tendencies prompted Carl Rogers to conclude in 1963, nearly two decades ago, that psychotherapy at the present time is in a state of chaos. The most diverse methods are used, and the most divergent explanations are given for a single event.